Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club. It is a podcast that's a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host is Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. And we hope that you've listened to the radio broadcast or the other interview that we've done with Blake Crouch. His latest book is Recursion. We're delighted to have him here at the Radio Book Club. And you know, this is all about memory. It's all about alternate timelines and what can happen and the unintended consequences of science. And you know, the fact that we talked about this in the other interview, there really does not seem to be an ethical approach to launching all of this new technology, whether it's social media, whether it's handheld devices, whether it's AI, artificial intelligence, which now seems to be the next reality that we're going to be dealing with. But are there efforts, because I know you do so much research, you know, in all of this kind of scientific areas, are there ethics committees, and say at MIT, I mean, this whole book was sparked by an idea of, you know, you heard about research done on a mice implanting memory. I mean, what ethics are out there when it comes to research? You know, are universities, do they have ethics committees? Do, you know, are they out there? Are there governmental ethics committees talking about any of this?
Of course. And there's a lot of people sounding the alarm bells. I mean, Elon Musk has been shouting for a while about the dangers of AI. But I'll give you an example. Take something like CRISPR. So CRISPR is the gene editing technology that came out 5-6 years ago, and they're honing it and honing it. And it's something that's going to have, you know, in 15 or 20 years, the ability not just to potentially eradicate diseases from our genome, but to help us design humans, to design animals, to literally design life. And yes, obviously something like that comes with so many ethical considerations, and you can have all the ethics committees you want. And then you have like China just going for it, doing all sorts of shady things, you know, breaking the test tubes. So you can't police the entire scientific global community. It's just not feasible. And I mean, something like AI, which is, again, it is the scariest thing, because for all of the warnings and all of the ethical considerations for, you know, going carefully and thoughtfully into the future of artificial intelligence, it could take one reckless coder, one reckless AI engineer who just doesn't care and just wants to see what they could do. And you know, you have the singularity, and the singularity is probably something that's going to happen not over a span of 10 years. It's a runaway chain reaction level event where you go from, you know, a general AI to a super AI in the span of hours or minutes or seconds.
I read this horrifying article, I can't remember what it may have been, in the New Yorker about a year or two ago, that posited that perhaps we're not in contact, we can't contact any aliens, we don't get anything from space, because every society, when they're about to get to that level, invents AI, and AI destroys them. And that's that. And so, you know, you can't get, one goes with the other. Like that level of a species getting to that level of technology inevitably will eat itself in a way.
It's fascinating. I think we're talking about, I think I'm saying it right, it's Fermi's paradox, which is the universe contains incalculable number of, you know, Goldilocks planets that exist in that really delicate zone for carbon-based life to emerge. And you would think just the sheer numbers and, you know, the probabilities would point to us having had some contact from someone, but it's just silence. So what is that? It has to be something. And I the explanation you just gave, I think, is the most convincing one I've read, which
that's
is that
it's so terrifying.
It's real. I mean, you know, just as we're getting to that place of being able to, you know, get out into the stars, you know, we also unfortunately are inventing the machines that will destroy our planet.
So, I mean, it got me thinking, because, you know, Helena in the book, she realizes what's happened, you know, and wants to go back and try to fix all of this. And so the question is, do we just not go down that road at all? Or is there a sweet spot where we say, okay, enough, we're not going to proceed? Or at any point, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. So is there an answer to all of this?
Of course, I think there's a sweet spot. You know, there's probably a sweet spot for, you know, religion. We don't seem to be able to circle that as a as a species. You know, we seem to have the extreme fringe adopters of science, religion, whatever, kind of wrecking it for the rest of us.
Well, it seems like even like what seems like innocuous technology that then becomes available to everyone then also becomes destructive. Because I was actually reading this, right, and I had the TV on, and an ad came on for 23andMe. Is it 23andMe? You can do the DNA testing at home. And the whole thing was, Father's Day is coming up. Get this for your dad.
Find out who your dad is.
Find out who your dad is. But the whole thing was like, get this for your dad. And I was like, I've heard so many stories of families being destroyed because somebody decides, wouldn't this be a fun thing for us to do as a family? And they realize, you're not my real dad. And this whole reality that I have lived in my whole life is not even true.
And you're also just taking murder off the table for your future. Like, forget committing a serious crime. I mean, once you do that, they're taking your DNA.
Yeah.
And you have no idea what they're going to do with it. They could take your DNA from this 23andMe and just hold on to it. And what happens in 30, 40, 50 years where CRISPR has advanced to the level of being able to really engineer humans from embryos? Then they can make a clone of you. I mean, that sounds like paranoid, you know, conspiracy theory level things, but it's not.
You know, T.C. Boyle wrote a great story about CRISPR. He wrote it was very humorous, but it was there was a cat dog. The animal was half dog, half cat. The grass was purple, like people designed their yard so it would be purple. And it was kind of an absurdist thing, but he just played with CRISPR as, you know, as far as you could. And in kind of this domestic area, like what kind of weird choices would just people make if they could just have it in their house and do what they wanted to do with their pets and their plants?
Oh, yeah.
And
it is the ability to create life forms and to augment it to suit whatever you want. I mean, I think it's fascinating, and you know, like there's two sides of the coin. There's the part of it that eradicates disease, and there's the part of it that makes you know, monkey babies. I don't know.
I mean, I think I don't mean to sound pessimistic, but I think it's unavoidable that it's going to be taken to its extreme, because one of the things about being human is being able to pursue your desires and so. Somebody invents CRISPR and there's 7 billion people. Like, somebody is going to mess with it and because they think it's right. I mean, you would almost have to have like a totalitarian regime over the entire world, like, to rein these things in. I just don't know how you can really do that in any meaningful way.
Yeah, and then we're living in 1984.
Exactly.
Land.
And then we might rather have been, you know, CRISPR'd out of existence rather than 1984'd out of existence.
I think we're solving right here the explanation for why we haven't heard from any other extraterrestrials.
Or maybe they're looking down on us going, forget it. Someone doesn't see what they've got going on. But, you know, in the end of the book, because you did write about how, you know, you've created so many different realities and timelines, it was a real challenge to rein the all in at the end. But at the end, you know, when the characters, we're not going to give away what happens in the end, but he kind of makes the observation, it's like, you know what, and I'll kind of paraphrase this, but you just got to go through with your life. And, you know, despite this idea that we want to redo all the bad stuff so we can have a do-over and eliminate that, it's like, you know what, life is about going through it and living through the bad stuff. And ultimately, that's kind of what we got to do. Right?
Yeah, it's unfortunately about pain. I got divorced after Dark Matter, and I think of Dark Matter was like kind of my pre-divorce book. Got to the end of that one, and I was like, "Ooh, this is." I think this is pointing me in a pretty life-changing direction. And Recursion is sort of my, I think, coming to terms with my divorce book, from the standpoint of, you know, it's an awful thing to go through. It's a good friend of mine described it as having a public nervous breakdown. It 100% is. It's like unraveling the worst knot possible in every that has tentacles in all parts of your life. And I was, you know, really just struggling and just thinking how, man, I just, you know, wish that didn't happen. Just really dealing with a lot of regret, much like this, mm-hmm. my Barry Sutton character. But, you know, it occurred to me, I'm sure it was also like great advice that was given to me from my support system of friends, that, you know, without, you can't just, everything can't just be great. You have to have the pain. I mean, it's like salt. If everything is just perfect, the worst thing you can have is just pure pain or just pure pleasure, because without both, they just become meaningless. Mm-hmm. And when I realized that, it sort of took a burden off of me personally, but I also, I thought it was helpful, so helpful to me coming to that realization, that I wanted to put it in the book and share it with readers.
Mm-hmm. Well, regret is you use the word regret, and regret is a big thing in here. You know, memory is obviously a big thing, but regret goes throughout the whole book. And you talk about Barry, and maybe there's some at least autobiographical feelings in Barry, or you know, things. But other characters have regret. Some are emotional, and some are regrets of ambition. You have one guy who regrets not building a crazy skyscraper.
My Amor Tolles character.
Yes, and so I just wonder what role do you think regret plays in all of our lives, and what does it lead us to? If we don't have regret, obviously, if we don't have memories, we're not really humans. But is to regret to be human to some extent?
I think it is. It's just, for me, it was realizing that regret is inevitable. Like, no one likes to go through painful periods of their life. And I don't think I'll ever get to a point where I'm like, oh, I'm so happy that, you know, this horrible thing is happening, because it's just going to make the great times feel better. But knowing that it is inevitable maybe helps us to not let it control us so much. Now, this book was also very much, I wrote this on my whiteboard early on, that it was this kind of anthem against nostalgia. Nostalgia, I think, is similar to regret in a way. I think it's putting a fake lacquer over memories. You know, our memories are so unreliable, and we, you know, things that we thought were happy moments or happened a certain way, when we returned, if we were able to return to them, we'd find that they were probably a little different than we had built them up in our minds. And I don't know, there's a great scene in, I think it's the pilot episode of Mad Men, and Don Draper is pitching the carousel, which is that the slide projector. He's pitching the slide projector to this group of, I think it's like the Kodak or something. And he says, you know, nostalgia comes from like an old Latin or a Greek definition that means the ache of an old wound. And I thought that's really interesting, because, you know, we think of nostalgia as being almost in a more positive light, but is it really? Is looking back, is fetishizing the past really a great thing?
We're living through that really as a society right now. I mean, this whole, not to get too political, make America great again. Mm. Let us go back to this time that seems to exist in certain people's memory.
Yeah, does this mean let's go back to what?
To what?
To slavery?
Yeah.
To Jim Crow era? It's like, we can't get too political, I know. But yeah, it's...
this idea that we can go back to some time when everything was perfect, but that time never exists.
No.
Well, you know, I was in Washington, D.C. Last week, and my wife grew up on Capitol Hill, and I spent about 3.5 years in the city. But this was I moved out here in 92 and from D.C., and she moved out here in 98. And the city has changed enormously. And we were just driving our poor 10-year-old daughter nuts, because we're like, that building wasn't there. What happened to the falling down, you know, shack that was here? What happened? I mean, our nostalgia. I mean, so... yeah, D.C. has issues. You know, it's gentrifying. Maybe it's not as diverse as it was. But when I lived in D.C., the D.C. that I'm actually nostalgic for was the murder capital of the country. There was 500 murders in 1 year that I was there. And it was the city of 600,000 people. And yet I walk around D.C. saying, oh, well, you could even go in this neighborhood. Now there's a Target there. What's going on? Well, the truth is, you couldn't go in the neighborhood.
I feel that way about my hometown of Durango. I moved there in 2003, and I'm sure this wasn't the case, but I just felt like back then, There was never a bunch of tourists jamming up Main Street. It was quiet and
I was a tourist in 2003 there.
Yeah. But people talk about that endlessly in the same way about Boulder, about Denver. And it's like, oh, change.
It's the change. You know, you just said it. I think it's the change. It's because what does change mean? It means time's passing. Yeah. It means time is passing us by. We're getting older. And that's what maybe we're really railing against.
Yeah, and you know, just like technology, though, the change also has unintended consequences. Like, DC is a much more vibrant city in many ways from when I was there, and there are all these amazing neighborhoods that you know just were either food deserts or dangerous. You wouldn't go to, but at the same time, the demographics of the population have really changed, and that's kind of the unintended consequences. That there are certain things, and they're not. But you can't balance everything, and that's the hard thing, is who gets to make some of these decisions on how things change. And I don't think there's any way that it would change in a way that we would walk down the street going, this is the greatest change ever, you know, but you do have to think about these unintended consequences again, even if it's neighborhoods or, you know, anything changing in your life.
Oh, yeah.
Well, in terms of you as a writer in your process, I mean, you described this whiteboard that if, you know, a random person came in, they might think you're plotting some major terrorist event because of all your various different things going on. But, you know, who do you read when you're looking for inspiration? Because you talked about this article that you read, MIT experiment on this mouse implanting memories that really sparked something. But, you know, do you like to read science fiction, or does that get you down too many kind of wormholes of possible plots as well? But what do you like to read?
Oh, no, I read everything. I'm reading the new Neal Stephenson book right now. I go back to books that I love and read them again. I think I read Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy every year.
And are they good when you read them again, or is it some kind of nostalgic on, oh, I loved reading that book?
Generally, they hold up because I'm finding things that I missed. And
that's the amazing thing about reading again. We hardly ever get a chance to do that. But when I do that, even if it's just a short story, I'm like, oh, I get it. Or sometimes I read a novel and I'll go back and read the first chapter again. Like, because, you know, you didn't know where you were in that first chapter.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that comes with being a writer is you end up having to read a lot of other writers' manuscripts. And, you know, it's everyone does it and you kind of have to do it. But I mean, a lot of my reading is reading friends' books and reading, you know, books that are sent to me to blurb. And yeah, I wish I had a little more time to just seek out things that I love. I'm trying to make more time to do that.
So in your books, in this book, there's a whole guide at the back about who the characters are kind of named after, sometimes directly, and other times maybe just the first name. How did you start doing this, who makes the cut here?
You know, this was such a hard book to write, and I have a big kind of an ecosystem of writers who are my friends, who I really respect. And at various stages during the process of writing this book, I mean, because I'm a writer, which means I'm insecure and I think something's working, but I'm not 100% sure. So almost everyone that's named in the back of that book read this book at various stages of during the process. Some of them, like my good friend Ann Voss Peterson, she is so good on character. Like, she will just pull out a motivation that's not really aligning. And so I'll send her things. You know, Marcus Slade is based on my friend Marcus Sakey. I mean, not based on him.
Named.
I enjoyed making Marcus the villain. So, yeah, it's sort of a bit of a love letter to all of my writer friends who helped me get to the finish line on Recursion.
It's a nice touch. I kind of liked it. You know,
thank you.
And the acknowledgments to see, like, who Barry Eisler, I think, was Barry, right? And there's... It's just kind of interesting how people come up with character names, and this obviously had a meaning to you. It wasn't just coming up with names that maybe sounded nice or...
That's also really hard, coming up with character names. it's possible there was a component of laziness involved. I was like, you know, I don't really want to come up with 25 new character names. Maybe I'll just base them kind of on people I know.
But what are you working on now? Because when you put so much into writing a book like this, you know, do you need a period of decompression where you got to clear your mind of all of these things before you can even contemplate starting a new thing?
It's less about decompression, although I probably do need that. And it's just more about taking the time to find the next idea. When I wrote Wayward Pines, that was the first book I did where I just felt this idea is kind of so big and crazy. I think it's stupid. But at that point, my career wasn't really setting the world on fire. So I was like, what do I have to lose? I'm just going to take a shot. And it just connected with a lot of people. I think, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. There's absolutely some truth to that in terms of coming up with big ideas. So I kind of made a pact with myself after Pines that no more small ideas. And the threshold for what it takes for me to start on a book is getting higher and higher. It has to have some piece of science that I'm really obsessed with that I think everyone thinks they know what it's about, but I have a way of setting it, or I know how to set it in a different light so they look at it kind of with fresh eyes. And I have to have some personal connection to the characters I'm creating. In other words, these characters that I'm writing about need to reflect what I'm going through as I'm writing the book. So it's taking more and more time to find the right ideas. But one like great idea is worth 100 medium ideas.
But we talked about some of the science that's out there now. From, was it CRISPR, the gene testing, to AI? There's plenty out there.
Oh, there's a lot out there.
Just waiting for that perfect nexus.
Exactly. It is a nexus of the science and the emotional.
When you've got to devote so much of your life to it, you better have that drive to really want to make it work.
Oh,
right?
100%. I am in awe of writers who can do a book a year. I mean, I have friends who write two books a year. I couldn't do it. I don't think I could I couldn't give myself the crash course in understanding the science, and also my weird process of, you know, writing as self therapy. It just takes a little more time.
Are you thinking about this for film? I mean, this is so cinematic.
Well, we sold it. Okay. I didn't know how this was ever going to be a two-hour movie. I didn't think it would be.
It doesn't have to be anymore, though.
Exactly. And so what happened is we sent it to a bunch of people, and I mean, everyone really loved it, and you know, a bunch of studios were like, yeah, we'll just make three movies. I was like, no, you won't. You won't even make one movie. But then Shonda Rhimes and Matt Reeves called, and they have overall deals at Netflix, and they said, we want to make a universe out of this book. Let's launch it with a movie or two movies, and then we could make multiple TV series that spin off and follow various timelines, maybe even some of the timelines like you were saying. You know, there are moments in the book that you imagine things continuing after that timeline died off. We can do that with a place like Netflix, who is breaking down the barriers between film and television.
Yeah, it's really interesting what they can do. I mean, you have some timelines where you just touch upon them and then you've got to move on kind of in the book. You can't spin them all the way out, but they do play out somewhere. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
And yeah, I mean, there's just sentences, single sentences in Recursion that could birth an entire series.
You know what it reminded me a little bit of was, I don't know if you've seen the second season of The Good Place.
No, I haven't seen it.
Because so The Good Place, it's like they have to reboot over and over again. They just do it in a couple episodes, and they finally stay in the universe or the dimension they're in. But it's but the first reboot takes almost a full episode, and then the second reboot is like the next two, or maybe you know, a half an episode, and then they show like the next 40 in like 10 minutes, like boom, 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 boom. Like, yeah. But you know, each one of those is like, has a little more to it than.
Oh yeah.
Than I mean, what you see, yeah. Obviously.
I don't know. We're in a really exciting time in terms of, you know, not making a book be film or TV. And it's really nice if you can find a medium that just fits like a glove with the book. And so, because inevitably, if this were to be a two-hour movie, I mean, it would be so much that I love about this book would be left on the floor.
Yeah.
I mean, they'd have to pick just a couple of timelines, right? Oh. You can't fit them all in.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, how does that make you feel to pass this on to another creative team who will then do something? I mean, gosh, you can't even imagine what, but...
Very happy that I'm not going to have anything to do with it.
You can destroy your whiteboard, or does that live somewhere now that's you know, preserved?
I have pictures of it, but no, the whiteboard is clean for the moment, awaiting the next bit of madness. I have adapted my own stuff before. I'm doing it on a novella I wrote right now, but that's a complete opposite situation because it's the script is expanding on the story instead of having to hone it down and condense it into something it may not want to be. So I was very happy to find people who are way smarter than me in Hollywood to have fun storming that castle.
You know, two very under, get back a little earlier, two very underrated character names in fiction are Maeve and Arsene.
You know, I agree.
We're almost never see either Maeve or Arsene.
How do you spell your name?
A-R-S-E-N.
Oh.
Yeah.
And how do you spell Maeve?
M-A-E-V-E.
I like that. All right.
Just putting it out there.
You have to understand the contract we enter into. If I put you in a book, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to go well for your character.
That's okay.
You could be the next evil genius.
That's all right.
I'll
be
your sidekick or vice versa. But we look forward to that. Whatever that will be when that nexus occurs for Blake Crouch. But in the meantime, Recursion is his latest book. I look forward to seeing whatever iteration it appears in on Netflix. That's mind-boggling, really, to think about the potential for this. But it's a great read. It's super, super... page turning. I don't know what the correct adjective for that is.
But it's a page turner.
It's a page turner. But Blake Crouch has been our guest after hours at the Radio Book Club, which is a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, Arsene Kashkashian is my co-host. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.